versus Malnati. Mr. Wixer.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Elliot Wixer, counsel. Your honors, this comes before the court. It's a Title VII case. This comes before the court on behalf of my client, Kathleen Lockman, the appellant plaintiff, on the lower court's ruling on a motion for summary judgment, granting that in favor of the defendant, Malnati's organization. Your honors, the judge made, in our estimation, the lower court made at least two errors. One was the obvious grant of the motion for summary judgment. The second was the application of the Ellerth case, which really, in our estimation, Judge, is irrelevant. And it's irrelevant because this is not a supervisory case, but co-employee to co-employee Title VII harassment. Coming to the conclusion that Farragher and Ellerth do not apply, this court, the Seventh Circuit, has applied a variety of cases that where co-employees sexually harass a female worker. Examples of that are found in the Seventh Circuit's rulings on Parkins versus Civil Constructors, Durkin versus the City of Chicago, and while Williams was not a Title VII sexual harassment case, Williams applied the co-employee standard in determining whether sexual harassment has existed or not existed. The lower court really wanted an answer as to why the affirmative defense ruling in the Ellerth and Farragher case would apply, and that affirmative defense is clearly inapplicable. Rather, based on the cases, the Durkin case, the Parkins case, the Williams case, the appropriate standard is whether this employer was negligent in discovering the sexual harassment, they were negligent in remedying the harassment once they found out. Durkin went on to also state perhaps a third prong of a test, whether the employee failed to take any affirmative action on her part when a proper or sexual harassment policy is in place. Beyond that, we believe that the lower
court... I don't understand your argument that Ellerth is irrelevant to co-employee cases. I don't understand. I thought the point of Ellerth was that if the employer, you know, had reasonable procedures in place, then he wouldn't be liable for this harassment. Isn't that the...
Well, Judge, I think that one could read that, and I don't disagree with Your Honor because we believe that the Durkin case followed that particular proposition. Durkin versus City of Chicago said where an employee fails to take advantage of procedures in place by this employer, then that particular...
That's your opponent's principal argument, right?
My opponent's principal argument is, I would respectfully disagree, but they do argue that, but that, of course, is disputed by the facts. I mean, the fact that this woman was supposed to perhaps call the supervisor in the corporate office, the fact is the supervisor, the day after it occurred, knew about this pervasive sexual harassment that was taking place in this particular location. So while perhaps it was an imperfect attempt to utilize that one mechanism, it was done. And in addition, Your Honor...
Is it the mechanism that you're complaining about? So they had a pamphlet or something, or had
there was
a
no
manual which contained something about harassment, didn't it?
There was a dispute. There was a manual. That's correct. There was a dispute whether that was given to my client to retain. And so... Perhaps she saw the manual, and when she was, and I'm not trying to grandstand before this court, it was a somewhat of violent acts that occurred to her in this location, she reported it to a manager.
I'm just asking about the procedures. So there is a manual, and do you regard the manual as inadequate, or the fact that she didn't retain it, or what?
I regard the manual as somewhat irrelevant to the conclusion that this court...
Why is it irrelevant?
Because in the Parkins case, it wasn't so much what... it wasn't so much the mechanism in place, it's whether this employer knew or had knowledge of the sexual harassment that was occurring in the location. And to look at this case and then to say these particular facts, to draw the conclusion that, yes, the phone call should have been made to the higher-up at the management, albeit the record reveals clearly that management knew about it the day after it occurred, not junior management, not management at the restaurant, but upper management knew about every complaint that she was making and did nothing about it in terms of a real substantive action.
Well, it did something. You know, you're not satisfied with what...
Well, but the something is, if you look at the Joe Hansen case as an example, this court talked in terms of the employer sticking its head in the sand. And when you have a 17-year-old young lady being locked in a cooler or being pushed down in a basement against her will and then have that employee told not to do it again, I hardly think the conclusion that any court can draw, let alone a jury, is that that is reasonable. And the other error I would assign to the lower court is...
Well, let alone a jury. I thought you wanted a trial.
Well, we want a trial, Judge, and the problem is that we were not...
insisting on summary judgment.
Well, we were not given that opportunity, but I don't think that the grant of summary judgment in this instance can be proper at all in light of the way the court analyzed the facts in this case. They took a very... The lower court, I think, took a very vacuum view approach, if you will, of this particular facts. They said three instances of sexual harassment occurred, and once those instances were dealt with, they were cured. But
that
is
a long stretch of time, too, though, wasn't it?
It's a long stretch of time, and the ultimate one of the employees was ultimately fired a whole year later, and that employee not only sexually harassed other employees prior to our client being sexually harassed, and we're not talking about mere whistling. We're talking about groping and touching.
Was he complained about?
He was complained about by two other employees prior to that harassment occurring to my client. And in addition, the Johansson...
Complained to Salas or somebody else?
Salas, they initially complained to Salas, but upper management knew about it.
I thought that the guy you're talking about, that Hernandez, is that the second guy?
The guy that was fired, Hector... If my memory serves, Hector was fired a year after our client complained, but it's possible 2 years after, 2 years after the initial complaints by the other employees that he was conducting himself in the same way as the way he conducted himself with my client. So there's two facets here. One, we believe that Johansson and Indiana Bell cases are very important to this court's determination because there were prior conduct that a jury could have considered to determine whether the ultimate punishment, if you will, by these employees was reasonable. But the court never got to those particular cases. And secondly, insofar as it relates to what happened after, I think the court erroneously concluded, based on the facts before it, that no other sexual harassment occurred to my client after this particular defendant slapped him on the wrist, but that's not the case. There was continual groping by the very same employee that was supposedly reprimanded. I'll reserve additional comments for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Andrews?
May it please the court, your honors. I'm Greg Andrews on behalf of the Malnati Organization, and this court should affirm the summary judgment decision of the district court for three reasons. First of all, there has been no proof that employer liability has been established in this co-worker harassment case. Secondly, the appellant has waived the Fairgrail Earth argument. They did not develop it, and this was noted by by the district court judge on the motion to reconsider. Third, even if we apply Farragher-Ellerth, which they now argue should not apply, it is clear from the record that Malnati's took reasonable care to prevent and promptly correct the harassment.
I don't really understand that. You seem to have a one-bite rule, right? So any employee can harass another employee, but is then warned that if he repeats that, he'll be fired. And they comply. But I don't see how a one-bite rule can satisfy the statute.
Your Honor, the one-bite rule, as referred to in the Longstreet case, it is very clear there that it is the action taken by the employer based on the circumstances at that time, as it is known. Is it reasonable? That is the question that's asked. Is it reasonable to warn someone? Well, certainly the first time Martine was warned when he harassed Ms. Lachman, he complied and stopped. They now bring up in an affidavit a prior situation, not brought up by Ms. Lachman herself, where they claim that he harassed someone else at that time.
That's not what I'm talking about. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm assuming, for sake of argument, that these guys only harass one person once.
Yes.
Then they're warned and they stop.
Yes.
Well, that's a one-bite rule, right? You get
yes,
one bite.
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
Well, I don't think a one-bite rule can comply with the statute. If you have a long history of, as you do, of this harassment, then to be effective, you have to fire one of these people on their first bites. Otherwise, you're going to have a constant stream of harassment with the worker turnover.
In this case, Your Honor, looking at what happened at the time, it was reasonable to warn them, and that is the test.
I know whether it's reasonable or not. It seems like a jury issue. Let them decide whether it's reasonable.
That
doesn't
first
seem reasonable.
As a matter of law, our facts clearly fit within the existing rule of law from the Longstreet case. We are not saying that, and the argument they are making here is that if we had fired Martine, Hector would have taken notice that Martine was missing and would have said, I should change my behavior. Nowhere in the case law have we found any rule that would say that firing one person should serve as an example to others. We have to take each case as we find it.
There's different degrees of harassment. It just seemed to me that especially that first incident was fairly egregious. The groping in the, was it the refrigerator room or something like that? That, an improper remark is one thing, you know, will you be my girlfriend or something, but this was pretty serious, I thought.
Indeed. We do not argue that based on, and as we must take her allegations as true for the purposes of summary judgment, that's quite serious. And they were warned, and they stopped and didn't do that again. A year later, she told more of a story, and there was a second investigation, and Hector was then fired. And I think that's important and goes to the second element of the Farragher-Ellerth defense, is that this is a young woman who did not come directly to management, but through a relay of coworkers would inform management. Management would intervene and warn the person. That person would stop. Another person, a year later.
What was her original complaint? This was the cooler incident?
I know, Your Honor, the original complaint was Martine, she claimed, tried to kiss her on the stairs.
But you say there was... And that was the one where it wasn't until later that they learned what had actually happened? Or I thought it was,
No.
It was the cooler.
In 2000, she complained of Martine. I'm sorry, in 2000, she complained of Martine. In 2001, she complained of Hector and Guillermo in the cooler. She told some of the story at that time. At a later date, her father...
Now, what did she tell at that time?
At that point, she said, they had their hands all over me, and Jim Solis intervened and warned, and they admit that...
So she said they had their hands all over her, and their response was to warn these guys?
They warned them that...
Well, that's feeble, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, we don't know what happened. No one else was in.
I mean, she's a minor, for one thing.
At this time, she was 18 at that time. No one else was in that cooler. Otherwise, we turn this into a Salem witch trial.
No one else was in the cooler. Did they deny touching her?
One of them did. One of them was not clear later upon a second investigation.
One of them was not clear. What do you mean by that?
One of them said, I didn't do anything. The other one said, I bumped into her. He never said he intentionally groped her. Upon the second investigation, we were not satisfied with his story, and we had further evidence at that time that he had continued to make comments, but had not touched her, but had perhaps made comments. And at that time, we fired him.
Isn't it a little disturbing, though, this comment about, you know, don't, they're hot-blooded Hispanics or something, and don't,
There was evidence
don't,
that...
Don't flirt with these guys or something like that.
There was evidence that one of the three female managers on site made some comment that you should stay away from these cooks and get back to work. There were concerns that this was blaming the victim, but there's no proof that this was said.
Proof that it was said? That's a matter for a jury to decide.
Even if it were said, even if we were to take it.
I don't get your even if. You can't argue contestable facts to us.
Your Honor, I'm not trying to argue a contestable fact. I'm saying that even if we take this as a fact here.
Well, we have to take it as a
and,
fact.
And we must. Then their statements to this effect show that perhaps it's not the perfect response, but there was a good response. They warned the person, and the person stopped.
I don't think it's a good response, and I think this remark about Hispanics, you know, doesn't help things. It's basically saying to her, look, you want to work in a place with Hispanics, you're going to be molested, right? That's the signal that's conveyed by that sort of comment.
It certainly could be if that
it
were the sole comment.
Precisely, yes.
But in this case, there was interaction between both parties, and there was concern trying to get the straight story from everyone. The employer behaved very reasonably by listening to both sides and telling both sides to stay away from each other in the future so that they did not interact.
Well, I don't know why she's supposed to stay away from them. Did they think she was making advances to them?
There was some evidence in the record to that effect.
Well,
and,
yeah, go ahead.
They were both told to stay away from each other. Martine, she testified, looked out for her after this. So it was very effective as to him. Hector, she complained of continuing to make comments, make her feel uncomfortable, and he was fired for this. Tom Schaller, the third incident, unrelated to the first two, and a third year later, he was transferred, he apologized, and the two of them never worked together again. So we have some effective remedial action, as the district court noted. The plaintiff has further argued that there was just a general atmosphere based on prior acts that were not necessarily noted or in any way similar to the Joe Nonson case or EEOC versus Indiana Bell. In those cases, those were supervisory cases. There was a ratification of the supervisor's behavior in each of those cases. In our case, clearly falls far below that. We have disputed facts between the parties at the time there in the restaurant, so that when we look at it, in 2020 hindsight, we can say, gee, if the folks on the site there had known more, perhaps they would have done something further. But based on what they knew at the time, and that is the standard that we must look to, it is reasonable as to their response. It's also important, again, to emphasize that the story changed and grew over time. She has admitted in her deposition that she didn't tell everything at first, and that later, during the second investigation by Mr. D'Angelo, that she then told more of the story. And this is admitted to in a statement of facts, paragraph 208, where she points out, or she admits, that the story grew in a retelling. They argue that perhaps there's a rule that a youthful victim should be granted more latitude and we should be on further notice to investigate further. But in this case, that would allow someone of tender years to merely point a finger at someone and have that person removed from the workplace for the very first allegation. And that would be the standard that we would move to. I see that my time has expired. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Andrews. Mr. Wickler, how much time does he have?
Just briefly, just wanted to point out in the Longstreet case, while certainly it discusses Title VII, the Longstreet case, there was no prior incidence of harassment, and what I think Malnati's organization wants you to do is disregard Johansson and disregard Indiana Bell. And while true, it was a supervisor case, all that was said in that case as it relates to these particular set of facts is that that evidence can be used to determine whether or not this employer was reasonable. Prior acts could be used to determine whether this employer was used reasonable methods to stop the harassment. I'll say something else quickly about Longstreet, is there was no physical touching there. And in Longstreet, in addition, the employer did something. The employer moved this employee to a totally different location in the Department of Corrections. The cases are much different. But factually speaking, you had Francis, who was an employee, who was harassed by Martin and Guillermo, Kathleen Lockman, our client, was later harassed. Each and every one of these employees that had prior harassment history harassed our client physically and egregiously. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much to both counsel. Next.